have $4 million to tear it down, so I say yes, give them a few more months.
A developer gets more time to come up with a plan for a deteriorating building in downtown Fairbanks. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, tribal leaders in the state paint a bleak picture.
They're escaping conditions in the villages. They go from one place of having a hard time to another place of having a hard time.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
With two big studies out on the Pebble Mine, there's been a fight over whether work by the Pebble Partnership or the Environmental Protection Agency is more credible. Now, a science panel sponsored by the Pebble Partnership has come out with criticisms of the partnership's own research. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
The Keystone Center Science Panel has been meeting this week to review the Pebble Partnership's baseline environmental studies for the mine that it hopes to build in southwest Alaska. The studies are meant to serve as a reference for what the region looks like now, without any major development. But some panelists have questions about the work that the partnership has produced. Falk Huttman, a professor of wildlife ecology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, expressed concern that the baseline reports hadn't fully considered the issue of biodiversity in the region. He also suggests that the work done on habitat use in the area was insufficient. But ecologist Robert McFarland had the harshest words, and he focused his criticisms primarily on the study of birds.
I can say that the document is adequate as a list of species that are present. It is not adequate for any type of study that you might want to come back to from some years in the future to ask, have there been any changes?
McFarland acknowledged that when it comes to building a mine, it'll be more important to look at the impact on fish than on birds. But he still slammed the methodology used to study the birds, calling the research presented backwards, frustrating, and disturbing. Terry Schick is the environmental consultant who handled the bird studies for the Pebble Partnership. He said they were limited in the field in how much data they were able to collect. And he added, their team wasn't given enough money to use more current methods.
We were not given the budget to produce those for this report.
Pebble Partnership study isn't the only big piece of research on the mine out there. In April, the Environmental Protection Agency released its revised assessment of the project, which concluded that a mine in the Bristol Bay region could affect major salmon streams. The Pebble Partnership has called that work deeply flawed because the EPA based its studies on a hypothetical mine plan instead of waiting for the partnership to file the plan that they intend to use. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says a proposal to have the state help pay for cleanup of abandoned federal well sites in the Alaska Arctic is dead on arrival. During a subcommittee hearing in Washington, D.C. today, Murkowski said the responsibility falls to the federal government. President Barack Obama has proposed temporarily halting revenue-sharing payments to Alaska from oil and gas development in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, and diverting it to a new fund. The fund would supplement U.S. Bureau of Land Management spending on things like cleaning up the well sites and completing land conveyances. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell says she shares concerns about the well sites, but says Alaska's revenue share seems to be a reasonable source to help address the issue in a tight budget environment. The city of Fairbanks is giving the owner of the Polaris building more time to advance a plan to renovate the vacant and deteriorating downtown high-rise. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Fairbanks City Council had set a March 30th deadline for Anchorage developer Mark Marlowe to take action on the Polaris or have it condemned. The city delayed action after Marlowe indicated things were happening with the long-stalled project. Monday night, the council voted to extend the Polaris deadline until September 30th, following an hour-long update on the project by Marlowe. Marlowe says some key pieces have recently come together that warrant optimism.
I have a new investor who is going to put in some pre-development money, which is critical to get things like the structural design done. We've retained a local structural engineer to accomplish that design. And the marketplace seems to be receptive for financing.
Marlowe says the crux of the Polaris project is that the estimated renovation cost of $19 million is more than the resulting $15 to $16 million the upgraded 1950s-era apartment building will be worth. Marlowe says federal loan programs can make the otherwise uneconomic endeavor work.
The federal government has taken a public policy decision that they are going to create opportunities to direct capital to projects like this for the specific purpose of mitigating urban decay. And so the reason that it makes sense is if our federal government in all their wisdom is going to subsidize the difference and make it worth your while, then I guess it's incumbent upon us to try to pursue that and attract those federal dollars into this community.
Marlowe proposes commercial business space for the first and 11th floors of the Polaris, with 117 apartments on floors 2 through 10. The building is in rough shape and requires extensive retrofit to bring it in line with current building standards. City Council member Jim Matherly led questioning by the panel at Monday night's meeting. Matherly says Marlowe's complicated private and federal financing scenario is nothing new, but there's no loss in giving him a little extra time to try to make it work.
We don't have $4 million to tear it down, so I say yes, give him a few more months.
Matherly says he remains suspect about the Polaris renovation.
We don't want to lose a big building like the Polaris. We love that building, but it has to be economically viable. But a lot's changed since he bought it in 05. And the market's much, much different. And my lending background leads me to believe, what's it going to be worth when it's done? And I think the costs have gone up. And he may need to reevaluate that. That's my big concern.
Matherly says it's irresponsible to spend federal tax dollars on a building if it can't produce enough income to support itself and pay back loans once the renovation is done. He says an updated study on rental demand is essential to assessing the project's viability. Marlowe says past analysis shows housing demand is there. He told the council an updated appraisal and engineering analysis for the Polaris are expected to be ready in 6 to 7 weeks. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Tribal leaders and representatives met in Anchorage last week to denounce the exclusion of Alaska Native tribes from the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization and other problems facing Alaska's tribal people. Harold Napoleon is the tribal administrator for the Native village of Paimute near Hooper Bay. Looking around the room at the sparse attendance, Napoleon said many of the tribes could not send representatives because they're broke. He said they're dealing with third world conditions because tribal governments have no land.
They have no land on which to exercise their jurisdiction. So the tribes are sovereign, but they're sovereign over air.
Napoleon said the Venetai court decision that stated tribes had no land rights and therefore could not tax was a great defeat for tribal governments. During a presentation, Napoleon ticked off statistics about Native people in the state. He pointed out that Anchorage is the area with the largest percentage of Native people, and the majority of them are young women with children. He likened them to refugees.
They're escaping conditions in the villages. The poverty, the violence. So this is a very significant number. They go from one place of having a hard time to another place of having a hard time.
He said 25% of Alaska Native children live in poverty. The VAWA reauthorization angered Ambler resident Virginia Comack. She says women are the core of the family and violence against them must stop. The Upper Kobuk River community resident says she often reads policy and helps interpret it for the tribal council. She says VAWA is an act of discrimination against Alaska Natives.
We've been able to do things in the village to try and minimize that kind of violence in our village. Violence against children, violence against women, violence against each other. We don't get the dollars that other people, other organizations get on our behalf, but we do it voluntarily anyway because that's our culture.
160 tribes in the state currently support three changes to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act to be put forward to Congress: restoring tribal ownership to land selected under ANCSA, restoring hunting, fishing, and gathering rights extinguished under ANCSA, and mandating enrollment of all Alaska Native children born after December 18, 1971. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering the Sitka eagle named Windex.
I pretty distinctly remember the call because he had flown through their window and kind of knocked himself out, and they have this eagle in their living room and they're like, what do I do?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaskan educators can earn a master's degree in educational leadership, special education, and more from the University of Alaska Southeast. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Alaska's tour industry expects more people to visit the state this year. More and larger cruise ships are on their way, bringing visitors through Southeast and across the Gulf of Alaska. Many tourists continue north, riding and flying to the rail belt and onto places north and west. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld takes a look at the season and one of its attractions.
Exhibit curator Jackie Manning is confronted by some imposing figures every time she enters the Alaska State Museum's main gallery. They're well-armed, well-armored mannequins displaying years of carving by Sitka Tlingit artist Tommy Joseph.
And when you first walk in, you're met by all six of them, and they're up, and they have this presence that I think really gives you the sense of, you know, what it would be like to encounter these warriors in life.
She points to one of the figures with an abalone-eyed helmet, shelled protective neck gear, and the historic equivalent of a Kevlar vest.
Every time I see it, it just leaves quite the impression. Because it's fully dressed with the slat armor and the collar and the tunic, and it has the bow and the arrow as well as the dagger, it's just such a beautiful example of all of the armor, you know, on one figure.
The museum is but one of hundreds of attractions and excursions ready for Alaska's 2013 tourist season.
It looks excellent.
John Binkley is president of the Alaska Cruise Association, which represents Princess, Holland America, and other large ship lines sailing Alaska waters.
It looks like this will be the first time since 2009 that we'll get back above the 1 million mark for cruise visitors coming to Alaska.
He says the ships will bring nearly 70,000 more visitors north this season. They'll come aboard 28 large ships, one more than last year. And three lines will send larger vessels, making close to 500 separate voyages.
The indications that we've gotten are that the prices are holding steady, which means that there's less discounting, and usually people that are a little more affluent than coming to Alaska this summer. So that should be good news for retail merchants, as well as those who have shore excursions that hopefully people purchase when they get off the ship.
The industry is cautiously optimistic that it'll be a great summer and total visitor season.
Sarah Leonard is president of the Alaska Travel Industry Association, a statewide tour business group.
Last summer, we know that visitors reached 1.8 million in Alaska, and that was the first increase we saw in over 4 years. And then with some new service being offered for this summer in new airline service and new cruise ship berths coming to Alaska, we see positive growth.
Back at the Alaska State Museum, dozens of Kay Field Parker's Raven's Tail weavings are on exhibit in a summer show called Playing with Lightning.
Lightning is one of the patterns. It's a triangle pattern that repeats, but it reverses.
Exhibit curator Jackie Manning describes Raven's Tail as highly geometric. The technique was out of use for about two centuries before being rediscovered in the 1980s. This is the final summer exhibits will be on display in this aging museum. It will be torn down next year and eventually replaced with a modern structure, including the State Library and Archives. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
An athlete from Fairbanks is hoping to make the U.S. Olympic speed skating team in 2014. Liam Ortega is a former national champion who was introduced to ice skating when he started playing hockey as a 7-year-old in Fairbanks. A terrifying speed skating accident nearly ended his career in 2010. He told his inspirational story to Bethel students recently. KYUK's Mark Earhart has more.
28-year-old Liam Ortega stands in the Bethel Regional High School gym, surrounded by middle and high school students. He's dressed in a red polo, black baseball cap, and no shoes, just socks. He hopes to make the U.S. Winter Olympics team for the 2014 Games in Sochi, Russia, where he would wear a little something different on his feet.
I'm a speed skater.
The Olympic speed skating trials are in December, so Ortega is in the midst of some heavy training. He says talking to young people is a part of that.
Right now, being out here in Bethel is a chance for me to share with the kids my approach to goal setting and also some of my training techniques and habits so that, one, I can sharpen my own skills because I can learn from them as well, but also just to all of us get excited. I mean, working with them gets me stoked about my training, and I hope that my lessons I'm sharing with them gets them excited as well.
One of the lessons focuses on running technique. Ortega says little changes in posture, foot alignment, and how one engages certain muscles can make a big difference.
I'll share with them strength drills, balance drills, agility drills, but mostly the bottom line is get the attitude, get stoked.
Ortega says people can do amazing things when they focus on how to approach their goals. That's something he's learned firsthand.
In 2008, a skater was doing a fast lap and hit me from behind on the ice, going about 40 miles per hour. I spent a day in a coma and a week in ICU. And after that week, I lost 16 pounds of muscle, and I went from being one of the top speed skaters in the country to someone who couldn't keep up with their mother on a 7-minute walk. So that recovery process was challenging, to say the least.
Initially, Ortega says basic things would completely drain him, like reading just 3 pages in a book. Even though he was skating again just 2.5 months after his accident, Ortega says it was a full 2 years before he was back to normal.
But what I had to do for myself and what I've turned to share with the kids is making that goal-setting process an active process in your daily life. I had to do that for myself simply because if you have a goal to make the Olympics, but you can't keep up with your mother on a 7-minute walk, the reality or the realistic vision of that isn't today. So I had to make tangible things that I could focus on today to see the progress for myself.
So little by little, he set goals for himself, and not just physical goals, but mental ones too.
The challenge isn't always the physical aspect, it's the mental aspect by presenting something that makes them feel nervous, put on the spot, uncomfortable.
One mental exercise uses a grid of boxes with the numbers 1 through 100 placed randomly throughout. Students have 1 minute to find and mark the boxes in chronological order. Ortega, who got the idea from a sports psychologist, says it makes people uncomfortable and forces them to stay calm and focused if they want to do well on the exercise.
I don't talk smack to the kids on this project because I think it's extremely hard as well. The number chart, I mean, that tests you to the limit.
And how many, on average, do you say can you get?
I can get probably over 50. I've practiced a few times, but not in a while.
And as for this reporter, well, I only got 6. But I'll do it with a little more focus next time. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A local legislative race in Alaska has caught the attention of the leftist magazine The Nation and is being held up as a model for political change elsewhere in the country. The April 22nd issue of the magazine calls Alaska's House Race 34 a lesson for the left. KCAW's Robert Woolsey spoke recently with the author.
Russell Mokhiber says he grew up in a political family and has been a political activist all his life. The last election cycle generated a huge amount of discussion about the relationship between money and politics. Much of it, he considers, whining.
Because anytime you hear people talking about the system is out of control, money, there's too much money in politics, there's too much corporate power. My question to them is, what are you going to do about it?
He sees the election of Jonathan Kreis Tompkins as an antidote to inaction. He thinks the 24-year-old Sitkin has, by his headlong plunge into politics, demonstrated that actions speak louder than words.
You hear a lot of rhetoric about Citizens United and corporate takeover of the country, and we need a constitutional amendment and all these big plans. Could it be that we just haven't figured out the fundamentals of democracy, how to run for and win office, even at the local level?
Mokhiber is solidly rooted in the left. He edits a high-end Washington, D.C.-based newsletter called The Corporate Crime Reporter. Mokhiber has covered Alaskan politics before, most notably the 2006 cruise ship initiative. One of the co-authors of the initiative, Gershon Cohen of Haines, was instrumental in urging Kreis Tompkins to make a bid for the new legislative seat recently created by redistricting. Cohen tipped Mokhiber to the potential story in Kreis Tompkins' unexpected win. Mokhiber then pitched it to The Nation, the country's most prestigious left-of-center magazine.
He was a listener. He connected with a lot of people face-to-face. And I think clearly, without that, he probably would not have won this thing.
This shouldn't be about parties anymore. It should be about policies and about the people that are going to be in government.
This is Gershon Cohen.
So it doesn't surprise me at all that it would be getting looked at by a lot of people around the country, and frankly, I think that's great.
Cohen was the debate coach in Haines when Kreis Tompkins was in high school in Sitka. That's when they first met. Cohen agrees with Mokhiber's assertion that Kreis Tompkins won his election by making personal connections, a strategy that undermines conventional thinking about party politics in Alaska.
People go, well, how come someone from the other party isn't running? And it's like, well, it shouldn't be about party. It should be about the people and about what they support and what they would do in office.
In fact, there were 7 unopposed legislative races last year in Alaska, 1 in the Senate and 6 in the House. In Mokhiber's hometown of West Virginia, in the Eastern Panhandle, there were at least 10 state House delegate seats that went unchallenged, any one of which could have been won with 3,000 votes. He's hoping the lesson of Kreis Tompkins' election sinks in.
So we're starting to do a recruitment drive where we're looking for, you know, passing around the article, looking for people who it resonates with.
Mokhiber is not expecting miracles. At the moment, he sees Kreis Tompkins as the exception to the rule in a political environment where constituents don't always come first. He wants people to look at this election and take heart.
Now, I think he's a special young man in a special district, and not everybody who's going to take this on is going to win or even come close. But the reason it's such a good model is because, from what I could tell, he put aside the rhetoric. And he went and he listened to people.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
In mid-April, a hiker in Sitka found an eagle dead in the woods. It was picked up by the Alaska Raptor Center. Ordinarily, this would not be a news story, except this eagle was wearing some jewelry. KCAW's Ed Ronco explains.
Okay, so the jewelry the eagle was wearing was a metal band from the federal government, which identifies the bird officially as 6293475. But around here, he was known simply by the name Windex.
Because he flew through a double-pane glass window.
Jen Cedarleaf works at the Raptor Center. She's flipping through Windex's chart, dated July 1995.
We did an x-ray. We checked for fractures and lacerations. Didn't have any fractures. Gave him fluids because he was in shock.
Were you part of this call? Were you here then?
I was here then.
Do you remember the call?
I do. Pretty distinctly remember the call because he had flown through their window and kind of knocked himself out, and they have this eagle in their living room, and they're like, what do I do?
Lee Kraus and his wife Tina still live in the house where it happened.
We bought it in 91.
In fact, Lee is sitting in the same place he was 18 years ago when Windex dropped in for a visit. He's at the dining room table with his back to the window, which is not more than 5 feet away.
A total explosion,
like
that's what it was.
Gun going off or something, and then I was just peppered up my back. I really thought somebody got me with a shotgun or something.
T Tina Kraus says the glass flew clear to the other side of the house, and when the eagle started coming to, they quickly put a throw rug on him, standing on the edges to keep the bird from causing more damage.
And our grandson was sitting there watching TV, and he says, "Holy cow, Grandma, does this happen often?" Because he's from down below.
How old was he?
He was about 8.
Raptor Center staff showed up, and with a makeshift stretcher, they took the bird off for treatment. The Kraus family cleaned up the glass and threw out the chunk of halibut that Windex dropped when he made his entrance. But that was not the end of things for the Kraus family. For starters, they made the front page of the Sitka Sentinel.
Picture of us in front of the window.
Eagle crashes party, sends guests flying. The Krauses aren't used to uninvited guests showing up at their home for dinner, but at least this one brought his own entree. Their visitor, a mature male.
The newspaper article led to mentions in the press outside of Alaska, and their house even became a tourist attraction.
We ended up putting a great big piece of plywood over the window here, and the tour buses would all park down here, and all the people, they'd tell the story about the eagle, and all the people walk up our little driveway and stand there and take pictures of our house.
Lee and Tina Kraus both say they've wondered what happened to Windex.
Yeah.
They think it just died of old age?
For the answer to that, Jen Cedarleaf takes me inside the Alaska Raptor Center.
There's flies buzzing around him already.
It is the day after Windex was found in the woods, and Cedarleaf is getting his carcass out of a plastic bag.
He's really stinky, so he's probably been dead a few days.
She positions Windex on a table, and we hide behind a lead screen as the bird is zapped by X-rays.
Okay, ready? Mm-hmm. It's going to beep when it takes it. There we go.
When the film is developed, we see a small little fracture on one of the bones in his wing.
I think his radius is broken, but I still don't think that's the cause of death because he should have been skinnier. He should have lost a lot of weight from having the broken wing, but I don't see anything else.
Windex was an adult eagle when he flew through the Krause's window. That was 18 years ago, which means Windex was probably between 20 and 25 years old when he died. That's about normal for an eagle in the wild. Cedarleaf says the fact that this eagle was found, identified, and returned to the same clinic where he was treated nearly 2 decades ago is extremely unusual, as is his claim to fame. Lee and Tina Kraus say they still tell the story of the day Windex came to visit.
Yeah, it's kind of sad. I thought he would live forever.
And, in a way, he just might. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Robert Woolsey and Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Mark Earhart in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska. Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business and welcomes students from across Alaska. Online degree programs and courses prepare students for professional careers or can be applied to your current career. Explore the options online at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.